Okay, are we working? Test, 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 test. No, you are not.
There we go. There we go. So, as I said last week, we're now starting into systems. So, of course, our first system is the integumentary system. Obviously, we tend to have a relatively intimate relationship with the integument system as a massage therapist because it's what we touch every time we're working with somebody, right? So we need to know a whole lot about it. So that's kind of it in a little cutaway. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in this skin to the point where, you know, it has a little bit of everything. It is, the integumentary system means covering or coating. So it is the skin system. Of course, that's a trivial pursuit question, right? What's the largest system in the human body? It's the integumentary system. It is like a coat. It is waterproof, washable, permanent press. It repairs cuts, burns, and rips invisibly, guaranteed to last a lifetime with some care. And basically, when we look at the integumentary system, we're looking at skin itself, we're looking at hair, and we're looking at nails, ultimately, because they're all related to the system. This is a little sort of picture that shows everything, and when you take your cursor and go over it, it shows you all the various things within a cube of skin. So it covers the entire body. It has a surface area of 1.5 to 2 square meters, and if we took it all off, it would weigh approximately 4 kilograms or approximately 7% of your total body weight. So it has got a fair amount of mass. It is there. So we can see it in all its various iterations here. You know, can be colored, different colors. It can be coarse, smooth, right? It's a lot of variations. So it is estimated that every square centimeter, so with your fingers, think of how big a centimeter is. How big the centimeter? The square is out of, because the slide's so big, right? But how big the centimeter, square centimeter? Pretty small, right? Okay, within that square centimeter, you have 70 centimeters of blood vessels. You have 55 centimeters of nerves. You have 100 sweat glands. You have 15 oil glands. 230 afferent sensory receptors. Afferent means sending a message from the skin to the spinal cord, therefore to the brain. So measuring temperature, tickle, pressure, all those sorts of things. And 500,000 cells that are constantly dying and being replaced just within that square centimeter. So when we touch somebody, we can affect a lot of change through all the fact that we have all these blood vessels and nerves in this area. The sense of touch, our ability to touch someone when we treat them, can have a significant effect on anybody. You're going to hear, you know, or get an impression from me and some other teachers, you know, that you have to get in there and you have to get at things that are broken or having a problem that we need to fix. And that's not incorrect, but you can, in fact, actually just touching the skin, you can start to affect change already because you're affecting these very many things, especially these nerves and blood vessels, to cause a change. And the rule generally is, whatever nerves sort of over, if you've got a problem area, the skin over that area shares somewhat the afferent nerve endings with where the problem area is. So by the sheer fact of touching skin and affecting those nerves, you're likely going to have some effect on those structures underneath the skin that tend to be having the problem. So it isn't always just about putting your elbow 6 inches deep into their back. It's also about touching that area and affecting change. Skin helps in temperature regulation and water content regulation. It does vary in thickness from 1.5 to 4 millimeters thick, depending on where you are in the body. It is composed of two regions. The outermost layer, the layer you can actually look at when you look at your skin, is known as the epidermis, and it is composed of epithelial cells, of which you've taken. Now you have a sense of what epithelial cells are, right? And then the dermis is the bulk of the skin. It is leathery and composed of fibrous tissue and lies deep to the epidermis. So, you know, when you cut yourself or you scrape skin off, or we're going to find out if you have a blister, you know, you have this epidermal part, which is, shall we say, colorless. Anybody here ever seen anybody who's dead? What color do they look? Yeah, almost like we say, almost like a wax candle, right? There's an opaqueness to the skin, but there's no color. Why? No circulation, and that's because the dermis has no circulation. So where you get the color of your skin is in the dermis, not in the epidermis. So the epidermis is an opaque kind of white color, and what we consider as being flesh colored arises from the deeper dermis, where the blood supply is going. So when you die, there's no longer any blood in the dermis, so the skin takes on that ashen kind of white color because there's no blood in the underlying dermis underneath that area. Okay? And it's where we make leather, even from animals. It's the dermis that we process to create. I'm actually watching I shouldn't say this on the video, but I'm actually watching a video right now. His name is Ed Gein, and he was a serial killer in the 50s. Before they knew the term serial killer, and he was known to take human skin and process and make leather out of it and make lamps, and covered his couches and chairs with it and that kind of stuff. They say the Leatherface was based after him. Does anybody know who I mean by Leatherface? A few Chainsaw Massacre fans in the house? No, not really. So we can see here it's everywhere, right? From our top of our head to our feet. Our nails, our hair, it's all represented into this particular system of the human body. So when we look at dermis versus epidermis, remember epidermis meaning the most superficial and the dermis being deeper, it is the dermis that's vascularized. So there is no blood supply in your epidermis. I always use the example, the young boy, and it's usually boys in elementary school that slide a pin through the skin in their hand, and out the other side, and it doesn't cause any pain or do anything. That's because the needle or the stayed within the epidermis, which has no nerve supply, no blood supply, hence you're able to do it. Nutrients reach, though, the epidermis through diffusion from the dermal layer. So think of the dermal layer as being deep, and through diffusion, material or compounds and so forth that the skin cells require to survive. Or to be, and the metabolic needs to be met is, arises diffusion-wise up from the dermis. The subcutaneous tissue lies just deep to the skin and is called the hypodermis or superficial fascia. So again, I talked a little bit about fascia in the tissue lectures. So this is where we start getting fascia lying underneath it. So we think about, I always use, I kind of always use this wall because it's nice because it's got all these sort of blocks here that kind of represent layers, and I start associating kind of this to some degree. So picture that this is, for now, the gray area is the dermal area, and then the what's called the inner subcutaneous tissue would be this white part. So this is where we'd find connective tissue and any kind of superficial fascia that lies underneath. So, when you get a needle in your arm for your flu shot, we can call it intramuscular because the needle is going into the muscle, but sometimes if a needle is placed just under the skin into the slightly deeper tissue but not the muscle, it can be called a hypodermic needle because it's going underneath the derma. Okay. The subcutaneous tissue is not considered to be part of the skin, and the subcutaneous tissue consists of adipose plus some areolar tissue. Anybody here ever cut themselves deep enough that globs of flat fat started coming up out of the wound?
Nobody.
Wow. What's that? Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. You've never seen that before? Yeah, so you can actually get a wound that goes deep enough into the subcutaneous tissue, and you will get globs of fat that will come out in the wound if the wound is large enough. Yes, the white stuff that's coming up out of the wound. Then you've done that? Yeah, it was a deep cut, wasn't it? A fair or a large cut. Yeah, so you get in and slice a little bit of that subcutaneous tissue off, and it's coming up out of the wound. Yeah, did you have to have stitches? Should have, but didn't. Yeah. Okay. Right. I've done it too, boning out chickens. I shoved a needle, a knife in, and these white stuff started coming out. So what the heck? Superficial fascia anchors the skin to the underlying structures and allows the skin to slide. So, I always use the back of my hand. The ability for your skin to kind of be pulled up and away and moved around is because of this relationship between the epidermis, dermis, and the subcutaneous layer. There's a fascia. It's a part that allows for the skin to be able to do that. Superficial fascia also acts as an insulator and shock absorber, and that's where the adipose part comes in, right? Adipose tissue is an insulator. And then it thickens when we gain weight. So it's usually the subcutaneous tissue and its associated adipose tissue that gets enlarged when we start to gain weight because our fat stores are starting to get larger and therefore it starts to grow in size. So you can see here, here's your epidermis at the top. Here's your dermis in the center. And then here is your subcutaneous tissue here. And this sort of all these globs of fat, and it's those globs of fat that come up out of the wound. Yeah. No, you can actually do nerve damage here at this point. But yes, if you get a relatively large area of paresthesia or anesthesia in a wound, you've gone into a bit of a larger nerve that lies a bit deeper. So it is the deep wound that gets into the larger diameter nerves that can affect large areas. But you know, you can get into these sensory nerves right here. Any yellow here kind of represents nerves. So you can see you do some nerve damage anytime you have a cut anyways. Question is, how much of it do you do damage to? But if you get, as I say, you get a large numb area, you've gotten deep and gotten into a very large branch of a nerve. So let's do the epidermis first. This is the superficial one that we can, as I said, we're kind of looking at. It is thick and heavy keratinized epithelial tissue. Do you remember my talk much about keratin at all in the tissue lectures, right? So it's a protein, right? So we're going to talk a little bit more about this, but for now we're going to talk about the live part. So we're going to go back to the wall here again, and now the gray areas become the epidermis, with the upper part being the superficial, although I know there's white on top of it, but we'll pretend it's open air at the top. But you can see we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 layers here, okay? This would be the dermis, and this is the epidermis. So we say here there are 4 cell types and 4 or 5 layers. So well, there's 9 here, we'll just pretend there's 4 or 5, okay? And I want you to understand that the live portion of your epidermis is down here at the bottom where it associates with the dermis, and then when we get up to the very top layers, it's dead. Okay, there's the cells are now fully keratinized, they have no feeling, they're just dead cells at the top. So when we are talking about these 4 cell types that are found in here, we're talking more about sort of, shall we say, the live areas of the epidermis. And there are 4 types. There's keratinocytes, melanocytes, Langerhans cells, and Merkel cells. So we can see here, from a microscopic slice, we can see the dermis here in this sort of light pink. And then we can see the epidermis here that's working its way up to the top. And you can see that there's, you know, some thickness to this, so it looks kind of solid because these are sort of the live cells doing their things. But these are kind of hollow because these are the dead cells just filled with keratin at the top. All right? So, keratinocytes. I talked about the cells being keratinized, and it's a protein. It's the keratinocytes that make up the greatest percentage of the cells in the epidermis. So basically, again, thinking about those 5 layers of these gray bricks, 85% of those are keratinocytes. And they produce a protein called keratin that allows skin to have its protective qualities. And these keratinized cells, or this keratin, they protect underlying tissues from abrasions, heat, microbes, and chemicals. So we have to understand that, you know, this protein that's embedded in these cells makes them highly protective because, you know, it's exposed to the outside world. That skin's exposed, and you can get road rash and scrapes and burns and so on and so forth. That's its protection for. These cells are highly connected by lots and lots of desmosomes. What's a desmosome? Now you know why you have to learn all that stuff. What's a desmosome? Do the cell membranes touch? No. What are they connected with? A protein. You don't want to ask those kind of questions to look around and everybody's looking down. They don't want to look up. Right? And in the inside of the cell, what is in there? In a desmosome. It's a plaque with what in it? Some kind of filament. Look it up. Understand, though, it's glued, right? And it's very, very strong and it's very, very powerful. We want the cells here to be very glued together. Why? And keep stuff in. Okay? because we're pretty wet underneath this skin, right? We've got a lot of fluid under there. You know, interstitial fluids are integral. You know, the best line I've ever heard is, humans carry their ocean. So if you think that we came out of the ocean when we were created from an evolutionary point of view, we brought the ocean with us. The ocean is inside of us. So we have a salty environment, a wet, salty environment, and the skin keeps that intact. Okay, to the point where if we lose too much fluid and we become overly dehydrated, we can die. So we have to keep fluids inside as well. So it plays a couple of roles that way. The keratinocytes are in the deepest part of the epidermis, and they stop dividing after reaching three layers from the dermis. So down here, they're dividing like mad, okay? And once they get a couple layers up, they stop dividing. They keep heading to the superficial or apical part of the tissue, but they've stopped dividing. They also produce something called laminar granules, which release a water-repellent sealant, which is a lipid or oil-based or lipid-based, that decreases water entry and loss. So the keratin provides support, but it also provides a lipid that makes our skin somewhat waterproof. Okay? So we can see it here. It's embedded within, and we can see how we have the melanocytes down in here. So we can see here, the keratinocytes here. So we're talking about keratinocytes. You can see these keratinocytes here. They're a viable cell, they're reproducing, they're attached together with desmosomes, and they're slowly filling themselves up with keratin. When they're down here and they're viable, they have organelles, a nucleus, and so forth. They're a normal, everyday cell. As they work their way superficially, you can see by the time they get to the top, they're just dead cells, and that's kind of where we'll get to. Okay, so the deeper layer is the basilar layer, or the basal layer, and cells found here are almost in a constant state of mitosis. So your skin is always dividing because the superficial layer is always falling off. How many people had a shower this morning and dried themselves off with a towel? You rubbed off millions of cells drying yourself off this morning after your shower. Okay? It's just natural. That's what the skin's made to do. So, you know, you don't see it in most cases because of the color of your skin. And the towel and so forth, but you do get skin cells that do accumulate in the towel, so that's why you kind of should wash your towel once a week, because you've got lots of dead skin cells in there that you don't necessarily see, even though you're clean when you're wiping yourself off with the towel, but they are dead. The newly created cells here, because if they're in a constant state of mitosis, remember, everything is migrating apically. So as the cells are dividing here, and they're heading upwards. And remember, as they head upwards, they start to die. So they divide until they get three or four layers up, and then they stop. But that means the cells down here in the lower layers, in the basal layer, they're still dividing. So as they're dividing, everything's getting pushed up. Up and up and up to the superficial layer, or the apical layer of the skin. So newly created cells push the mature keratin cells up towards the surface. Now, we said they divide only for, you know, a few layers, and then they stop dividing. As those non-dividing keratinocytes are moving upward, they make the keratin, which eventually fills the cell itself or the contents within. So down here when they're dividing, they have all the viable parts of being able to bite, right, nucleus and organelles and so forth. After two or three layers, they stop dividing, but they're still being pushed upwards by those cells that are dividing below, and as they're moving upwards, they're starting to fill themselves up with keratin, okay? By the time they reach the apical surface, they're dead, and they don't have anything else in that cell membrane but keratin. So no more organelles, no more nucleus, it's all gone. It's just a cell membrane filled with keratin, okay? So as we can see here, they're dividing here. They're kind of done dividing here. You can see we've got lots of nuclei here. Some nuclei here. By the time we get here, no nuclei left, no organelles left, just filled with keratin and dead. We rub off millions of these cells every day, and we end up with a new epidermis every 35 to 45 days. So your skin and your body is completely replaced around once a month, month and a half. In healthy skin, new cells produced equal cells lost at the surface. and they only have a certain life, right? 45 days at most is what they generally tend to live. Anybody with psoriasis, for example, the problem with psoriasis is that the cells don't live 45 days. They only live 15 to 20 days, and they get all stuck together. And because they get stuck together, they don't fall off. So if you know anybody with psoriasis, you get these big plaquey buildups that are white and scaly and crusty. And it's simply because the cells in someone with psoriasis don't live long enough and they start jamming all up and become these large accumulations of skin cells. And that's all it is. And then, of course, because you have this accumulation of cells, then you get an inflammatory response, which leads to the redness and all the things that come with psoriasis. So it's that's where I say in healthy skin. So it's this ratio of creation of cells and dying off of cells in some disease states. Once that ratio starts altering, then you get skin problems, for example. Friction areas have a greater mitosis to cell loss production. This is partly controlled by the epidermal growth factor. So ladies, what do you do when you have calluses on your feet? What do you do? You take an emery board or a stone, pumice stone. You sit in the tub till they get nice and soft, and you grind them off. Okay? Friction areas have a greater mitosis to cell loss. So when you are fracturing off the calluses, you are in fact stimulating epidermal growth factors, so therefore the cells are speeding up. Hence the reason why you can never get rid of them, because what you're in fact doing when you're scraping them is stimulating them to come back even faster. You know, guys don't really care if you have callous feet. I don't know if this beauty thing with it. I don't understand it. Because calluses come where you have friction, such as sandals, shoes, right? So it's I used to play a lot of basketball, and at the beginning of the year, I'd always get a blister or two because my skin hadn't built the calluses to, run around the gym, and you'd have to give it a few days to, a couple of games or weeks to do it. So you have calluses for a reason. It's the body's reaction to high friction to protect the tissue from getting damaged. So they kind of have to be there. That's blood. That's blood supply, actually. Male pattern balding is usually due to cholesterol. So the blood supply to the hairs get jammed up with cholesterol, and the blood supply to the follicle diminishes, and the follicle dies and doesn't get replaced. That's why some medications are working, because it's stopping the accumulation of cholesterol in the blood supply to the follicle, and the follicle gets what it needs, and it stays healthy, and then the hair comes back. Melanocytes, they are a specialized cell which produces the pigment melanin. They're found in the deepest layer of the dermis, so the epidermis are way down here, and they provide pigment. They're kind of spidered shaped. In other words, they have lots of branches that head out and touch all the melanocytes, the keratinocytes. They make contact at the basal layer, and the melanin is a pigment that's produced by melanocytes, and they are basically in a membrane-lined granule within. So think of, when we were talking about those little vesicles that float around when we were talking about cells. So think of a little vesicle that's got a membrane in it, and within that membrane vesicle is a pigment, and within that are these granules of pigment, and that combination of the pigment and the membrane and what's in there is called the melanocyte, or melanosome, sorry. So, right? So it's that that causes the skin tone color. So we can see here that we've got these melanin granules floating around the cell. You can see them here as well, these melanosomes. And the melanocyte will, with these projections or fingers where they touch these keratinocytes, they release these melanosomes into the cell, which changes or affects the color of said cell. So the pigment is then moved off the ends of the processes and sloughed off. Nearby keratinocytes ingest that pigment. Now, the pigment, the melanin, accumulates on what's called the sunny side of the cell. So think of, if this represents the cells here, the apical surface at the top, that would mean that the melanosomes and the pigment aggregate here to the sunny side, then causing a color change in the cell itself. So it accumulates on the sunny side of the nucleus of the keratinocyte to shield against UV rays. And it was thought to be UV rays. There is some somewhat recent research that suggests the other reason for melanocytes and the pigment change of skin is to protect against iron loss. And they've noticed that people who are of Caucasian nature versus those who have darker skin, that we tend to have problems with iron a lot more than those who live in, so we'll say, traditional what we'll call sub-Saharan Africa, where their skin is darker and they're able to protect themselves more against the UV rays, but they're also discovering also against iron loss. This is one of the reasons why all that work to outlaw women in particular at a childbearing age, I believe it's now, what, 20, 21 before you can use a tanning bed? Like 18-year-olds can't use a tanning bed, right? Isn't that what I'm correct? So they maybe it's 15, 16-year-olds. It might be a bit younger, but there is a bit of a law in the books that we don't want young women using tanning beds because of the fact that it can affect change with iron and what happens when you're low on iron and you happen to get pregnant. Anybody know? So when you're pregnant, one of the vitamins your doctor will give you is ferritin. Why? Because low iron equals a condition called spina bifida. This is why they want to ensure that if a woman is pregnant, that she maintains a high level of iron or through ferritin to prevent any neural, it's called the neural tube malformation. The spina bifida is one of many. So they'll put pregnant females on those pills to try to avoid anything like that happening, right? So the thoughts are that the other process of this whole thing to the sunny side and the sun and the UV rays is also to protect vitamin B levels, thus preventing any kind of, for example, malformation at birth. All humans have the same relative same amount of melanocytes. It is likely the production of melanin determines the color of skin. So we can see here that these melanocytes, again, through these granules, granules are getting picked up by the keratinocytes, and we get the color of the skin that we get. I always have a little discussion here on the history of mankind and the color of skin. Because if you look at the sheer science of it, we have pigment cells that give the variation of colors that we see in the world. Red, yellow, black, brown, whatever it may be, white, makes no difference. And yet look at all the horrible, stupid philosophies that have come out of something that's a cell that colors another cell. And the terrible things that have happened to people, and it just behooves me that all it is a cell that gives a pigment to skin. Skin is a particular color, and we've gone off and made all these horrible, terrible assumptions based on it. It's brutal at best. The next are called Langerhans cells. These arise out of bone marrow, and they are basically macrophages. Yes. I don't know. I just sort of took that out of the book. As far as I'm concerned, they do produce skin color. So Langerhans cells produce macrophages. And now you all know pretty much what a macrophage is, right? Through inflammation and healing. They're big cell eaters. They're part of the immune response and so forth. So they are in and around these keratinocytes. Again, if anything tries to get through the skin to, you know, invade us or attack us, we do have impregnated macrophage cells within these cells of the skin itself of the epidermis that are sort of a, shall we say, a somewhat a first line of defense if anything is attempting to get through skin to get in at us and to infect us. Merkel cells, these are found at the dermal-epidermal junction. So we can kind of see the Merkel cell here, right? Right here, and we can see here is the Merkel cell in purple here, right at the dermal-epidermal boundary, and then we have a nerve that's associated with it. So we can see it here. This is known as a Merkel disc. It is a tactile afferent nerve. So tactile means touch. So your ability to know that someone is touching you, even with your eyes closed, it's association between the Merkel cell and the Merkel disc that gives us a sense of touch. So it is shaped like a hemisphere, and it's intimately associated with the disc-like nerve cell called the Merkel disc, which of course is an afferent sensory nerve. So it's a tactile nerve, which helps us sort of feel touch. So we can see it here. The cell is within the tissue, and the Merkel nerve itself with the associated disc comes through the dermis and opens up, shall we say, at this dermal epidermal border where we find these Merkel cells. All right, so I said that there were a number of layers to the epidermis. And guess what? Of course, science being science, each layer has its own name. So, in thick skin, there are 5 layers, and in thin skin, there are 4. Okay? So, think of, you know, the sole of your feet where you heal, you might have that callus or that thicker skin sort of going on. There's 5 layers there where maybe the skin on the inside of the leg is a bit thinner. We're down to 4 layers. So it's stratum. They're all called stratum or stratum, which means layer. And from deep to superficial, the deepest is basale, then spinosum, granulosum, lucidum, and then corneum. And it is the lucidum that's absent in thin skin and present in thick skin. So lucidum is absent in thin and present in thick. So you can see from A to E, A being the deepest, E being the most superficial. Okay? And we're going to talk about them. But you can see them here. Here we've got, you know, from deep here to superficial. Here's our stratum basale here. Here is spinosum, granulosum, lucidum, and corneum at the top. Sound like maybe a question I might create to somehow. So let's go with the deepest first. Basale, it is the deepest. It is firmly attached firmly to the underlying dermis along a wavy border. It is a single cell of stem cells. So this right here, this lowest layer of block would be the stratum basale. Okay? Got the dermis here. And then we have the stratum basale, except where the wall is straight, it's more wavy. It goes up and down like so. Why? What did I tell you wavy usually gives us? Increase in. Yep, due to an increase in surface area. Right, by waving it, we get a lot more surface area in a smaller package. So the waviness allows for it. Then, you know, if you've been driving around town and they're putting new asphalt in, what do they do to the old asphalt? They grind it and make it all wavy and then put the new asphalt on top, and it helps bind it better and gives a greater surface area for the new asphalt to bind to. So it's a single row of mainly stem cells. Stem cells are what? Do you remember? They're cells that don't know what they want to be yet. So stem cells can become something. In this case, they get influenced to become keratinocytes, generally. So they're going to go in there. Now, it does have another name, basale, also known as stratum germinativum, tibium, which basically means to germinate is to create, right? Sort of the same term. I don't generally tend to use this. The book doesn't use it either. It uses basale. But there's lots of mitotic nuclei here. So there's lots of, these stem cells are constantly, through mitosis, differentiating into what will be eventually become keratinocytes. So it's happening a lot. And of this area, 10 to 25% are melanocytes. And on those occasional times, of course, as I said, we do find Merkel cells, which we talked about. So we can see here, here's our stratum basale here. Here's the melanocyte. Right here with its extensions going out to affect the keratinocytes. We can see here is the Merkel cell within this layer as well. And we can see here the artist has actually drawn in a cell that's dividing to replace as the cells are, remember, heading from deep to superficial. Right? Everything's heading from deep to superficial. Our next layer is the stratum spinosum. Several layers thick here. So rather than where basale was one layer thick, spinosum is a number of layers thick. It contains thick bundles of intermediate filaments called tonal filaments. These tonal filaments contain pre-keratin. So the whole purpose here is to provide strength through reacting against tension. It's what gives skin our ability to stretch a little bit and not tear so easily. So again, within these several layers, we have thick bundles of intermediate filaments called tonal filaments, and they contain pre-keratin, which helps resist the tension. The keratinocytes here are starting to flatten and becoming irregular. And we see lots of Langerhans cells here, which of course are the precursor to macrophages, which are part of attacking anything that's trying to get in, right? So we can see here lots and lots and lots of layers of cells. Again, basale is here, spinosum is here. We can see a Langerhans cell here, and we can see these keratinocytes that have arisen out of this basal layer. The next one is stratum granulosum. It's found at the middle of the epidermis, consists of 3 to 5 layers of flattened keratinocytes undergoing apoptosis. Apoptosis is controlled cell death. Okay, the cell is deliberately dying, which means it's breaking down its genetic material, its organelles to be removed to those components used somewhere else, so that the cell is going to die and become empty, which will allow all the keratin to go in. Okay, so it's controlled suicide, basically, is what apoptosis is. All right, so the cell is deliberately trying to die at this point. The nuclei and organelles of the cell are beginning to degenerate. The tonal filaments start to become more obvious as compared. And again, remember, they're these tubes, and they're protein in nature, so they're very, very powerful. Within the keratinocytes is what's called a laminar. There's a presence also of a protein in here called keratohyalin, which converts tonal filaments into keratin. So we have the tonal filaments in this layer, and you can see them here, all the little lines that the artist has drawn in. But by the time we start getting up here into this layer, we don't need them anymore. So the keratohyalin, what it does is those bands, those tonal filaments, they are no longer necessary at the more apical levels, and they need to be basically converted to hyalin as well. So there's not everything eventually, as I said, the nucleus, the organelles are all dissolving, degenerating, and disappearing. The cell's becoming hollow. It's died off, apoptosis. Even these tonal filaments, they're all starting to break down, and everything is becoming keratin to fill the cell. So the process is always, at this point now, empty the cell out, fill it with keratin, okay? Within the keratinocytes is laminar granules, which are membrane-enclosed and produce this secretion that helps the skin become a little bit waterproof within the context of itself. The secretion fills in the spaces between the stratum granulosum, stratum luceum, and stratum corneum, acting as a water-repellent sealant. Now, because their nuclei break down, they no longer have any metabolic processes, so they no longer can do anything. They can't divide. They're just a membrane with keratin, the protein keratin. This layer makes the division between the metabolic active cells and the dead cells. So we can see here, they're still somewhat alive but dying, and by the time we get superficial to it, everything's dead. Everything proximal or deep to it, everything's still somewhat alive. The next is lucidum. It is a translucent band. Again, a few rows of dead keratinocytes with indistinct boundaries, but again, only present in thick skin, right? So we don't see it in thin. And then, of course, the most superficial is the corneum. It's the outermost layer, 20 to 30 cells thick. It accounts for, even though the epidermis isn't entirely thick, it still accounts for approximately 3/4 of the height or thickness of the epidermis. So all these lower layers are quite small, quite thin. The majority of epidermis is these dead cells. The cells are composed of a plasma membrane and keratin, as I said. They do protect against abrasion and penetration. And again, we find this glycolipid here, which makes it waterproof. And these dead cells do protect the body from things like biological, chemical, and physical results. If someone has dandruff, It is the accumulation of this layer that sits around the skin cells, on top of the skin cells and around the hair follicles, or where the hair comes out of the scalp. That's where dandruff represents as being these sloughed off dead keratinocytes of the stratum corneum. The average human sheds 40 pounds of skin in a lifetime. Where does it all go? Where does it go? Think about that. Every human being on earth sheds 40 pounds of skin. Where does it all go? Anybody know? What's that? Dust what? How many people here are allergic to dust mites? Okay. You're not actually allergic to dust mites. You're actually allergic to their poop. The reason why we don't see our skin anywhere is because that's dust mites' meal. That's what they eat, is dead skin. And what you're allergic to is what they secrete after they digest skin cells. So the reason we're not buried in skin cells above our heads is because of these great dust mites that eat up all our dead skin. How many people here haven't changed their pillow in about 5 years? Seriously, how many people haven't changed their pillow in a long time? Nobody wants to say that, but everybody has their favorite pillow that they like to curl up with, helps them sleep every night, right? Can't imagine a different one. In 5 years, that pillow is completely infested with skin cells and dust mites, just munching away like crazy in that pillow, even with pillowcases on, unless they're plastic. Because if your skin won't go through.
They don't live on you. They live on you.
They live in your pillows, in materials like your couch, your mattress of your bed.
You don't have to exfoliate.
Right. And they just walk around. Have you ever seen them? Look it up on your computer. Look up look up on Google. Look up dust mite. Now they're microscopic. Like, they're not something that you will ever see. Yeah. Yeah. But thank God they're here. Because if they weren't here, we'd all be buried in skin. So that's what they eat. And of course, like normal, they have a digestive tract, which means byproducts get excreted. And that's what you're allergic to. No. They live in a microscopic world and eat all these skin cells. They're crazy ugly, eh? No. But yeah, this is where, again, you have to consider, this is, again, a pillow. If a pillow is 5 or 6 years old, it's infested with these things. And your skin. Same as your mattress. Your mattress is full of skin cells and mites, too. But again, thank goodness they're there. But 40 pounds, that's a lot of skin. And as I said, when I was talking about drying yourself after every shower or washing your face with a face cloth, right, you are taking that superficial layer of these keratin-filled cells, and you're, by a friction, you are rubbing them off every time you use a towel to rub yourself. Right? It's just the way it goes. It's deliberately there. That's what helps protect us. So we can see here then, all these layers, just know them, understand where they are, deep to superficial, and what you tend to find in them. Any questions? I must tell you, on your skin, we're going to get into immunity a little bit later on, but you have bacteria that lives in this environment on your skin, and you need them. So you have symbiotic bacteria that enjoy these dead cells in your skin, and they need to be there. How many people here use antibacterial soaps, hand soaps? Throw them out. Get rid of them. There's no need for them. Unless you're doing surgery, you don't need them. You actually want them there. One of the things you don't want to do is use soaps to kill off all the flora that lives on your skin, because now you've increased the probability of infection. If you're doing things like medical procedures and that, absolutely you want to destroy any bacteria in your hands and so forth. But for day-to-day living, just normal soap and warm water washes off the bad bacteria and maintains the good bacteria on your skin. Yeah. I think they have their point. If you're in an environment where you have the potential, say you're grocery shopping and you know other people have handled your grocery cart, you know, to wipe your grocery cart handles or just do your hands afterwards in a kind of a very sort of public environment like that's usually a good idea, but I would not want to be using them all the time. And I would never use an antibacterial over my whole body. There's no need for it. Just regular soap. Regular everyday soap. Okay, so we've done the epidermis. Now we need to do the dermis, which lies underneath. So obviously there's a lot more to talk about in the dermis. It's a little more, shall we say, alive and has a few more functions. So we have to spend a little bit more time here than as compared to the epidermis. So the best way to explain it is we have this epidermis of these dead keratinized cells, but again, they don't, remember I said they don't have the ability to feed themselves. I said previously that, you know, to feed these stem cells and these dividing cells in the deeper layers of the skin, where do they get all their metabolic needs met? They get their metabolic needs met by the fact that the dermis has blood supply, and through diffusion, things cross into the dermis to feed these lower live cells. Because by the time they get up there, there's no need for blood, right? That's the other thing about the epidermis. It has no blood supply and it has no nerve supply other than these Merkel cells. But you'll notice that the actual nerve itself didn't cross into the epidermis. The Merkel cell was in the epidermis, but the nerve stayed in the dermis. So it is somewhat aneural and avascular, whereas, of course, the dermis is very vascular, very nerve innervated. Because it's down here, it's the lower part that we're, you know, everything's kind of going to feed through diffusion, these lower things. So the dermis is a very strong yet flexible connective tissue layer, and the cells found here are typical of cells found in connective tissue. So I asked this question, and I think I've asked this before. When we look at epithelial versus connective tissue, what's the criteria to determine what kind of epithelial tissue you're looking at? Or how do we know it's even epithelial when we look at it under a microscope? How do we categorize the name of epithelial tissue? It's what and or what? How many cells? So if it's one layer of cells, it's simple. If it's many layers, it's stratified, okay, and what cell shapes do we have? Cuboid, squamous, and columnar, correct? Okay, so you could be fair to say that when we try to categorize and standardize or recognize that what we're looking at under the microscope is epithelial tissue, it's all about the cells. How many, what shape, what do we look at when we're trying to standardize and define connective tissue? It's all about what? Is it about cells? Right. It's all about fibers and the matrix, right? The ground substance and so forth that's around it. It's not about the cells, okay? So connective tissue ain't about cells, where epithelial tissue is very much about cells. So when we make a comment like this and say, you know, the cells found here are typical found in connective tissue, fibroblasts create what? Fibers, right. Macrophages, of course, and white blood cells. Macrophages and white blood cells are both part of the immune system. The immune system relies on the cardiovascular system for those cells to get around and go where they need to go. So because the dermis has lots of blood supply, of course we're going to find blood-related immune cells in this tissue simply because it has blood. So we find macrophages, white blood cells, and mast cells are related to the immune response when required. That's why we find them here, okay? So again, connective tissue, fibroblasts for fibers, and so forth. the dermis is, it's the matrix, as I said. The other thing that's important about connective tissue is this matrix, right? The spaces between the cells. Because remember, epithelial tissue was all about desmosomes, right? Adherins, because the cells are always jammed together. In connective tissue, cells are there, but they're quite spaced apart. And between the two of them, we have the matrix and ground substance and so forth. So that's one of the distinct differences. So we say the semi-fluid matrix is embedded with collagen, elastin, and reticular fibers. Now, what do you remember about collagen, elastin, and reticular fibers?
Ooh,
told you this stuff keeps coming back. What? It's the distinct difference between all three of them, please. Anything. Okay, so maybe stronger might be a better word than harder. Much more powerful, right? Yeah, what else? What about elastin? Yeah, what's the definition of elastic? It goes back into its same shape, correct. So you have the ability to have a lot of strength. You have the ability to pull it, and it will boing, bounce back into shape. And reticular fibers do what? Sorry? Right. It's kind of like a netting, right? Like a net that kind of wraps around. So we need all of them in here because of, remember, structure governs function. And we think of the rule of skin and what it needs to do. And because it's exposed to the outside world, I mean, we tend to forget because we wear clothes, but our predecessors didn't wear too much, right? You know, didn't wear leather shoes with a nice big sole on it. So, you know, our skin was relatively exposed to, you know, rocks and sticks and trees and so forth. And it needed strength to be pulled and so forth. So we have to remember, although we divide the epidermis from the dermis, there still is a very strong relationship between the two in their roles. So it has collagen, elastic, and reticular fibers. The dermis binds the entire body like a stocking. In other words, this is your hide. It is richly supplied with nerve, blood vessels, and lymphatics. So, you know, it's the live part of your skin. And as I said earlier, it's also what gives skin its glow, because it's this blood supply through this semi-opaque epidermis that we get our color up and out of. Hair follicles, oil, and sweat glands all reside in the dermis. They extend out through the epidermis to get to where they're going. So our hair that we see, of course, goes through the epidermis to where we see it. Our oil glands come up to the surface to release oil onto the surface of the skin and so forth. They arise in the dermis, penetrate through the epidermis to exist outside the skin itself. Hair follicles, oil, and sweat glands reside in the dermis. So we can see here, we have our epidermis at the top, which we just discussed with its four or five layers. We then have the dermis here with connective tissue, blood supply, nerve supply, and lymphatics. And as we talked about earlier, we have the subcutaneous layer that lies deep to that. So the dermis. There are two layers to the dermis. So where there were four or five in the epidermis, there are only two layers to the dermis. There is the papillary layer and the reticular layer. So we can kind of see them here. The sort of skin tone here is the sort of browny beigey area here is the epidermis. Then we have the dermis between the subcutaneous tissue and the epidermis, and there are two layers here that you can see. The papillary layer here is going up like so, and then we have the reticular layer down here below. So the papillary layer is a connective tissue in which the fibers form a loosely woven mat. Think of like a laid out semi-flat. There are many blood vessels in this layer, and the superior surface of the papillary layer is thrown into nipple-like projections called dermal papillae. Right? So that's why papillae represents nipple-like. So they're very distinctly raised. They're not, you know, like a smooth sort of rise and fall. They're very distinct. They do stick up, and you can see them here. So here are your papillae. You can see they distinctly rise up. Here you can see in the microscopic version, here is the reticular layer of the dermis. Here's the papillary layer. And you can see these papillae extending up into the epidermis. Why? Why have them? We've already answered the question kind of somewhat another different way. What's that? For? But it allows for diffusion, but what does it increase? Surface area and provides strength, right? Think of, you know, stick your fingers up into something, it's going to be a lot stronger than if they're just flat against it, right? So it increases surface area for attachment and helps provide strength. And through increased surface area, we have increased surface area for diffusion, which helps meet the supply for it, okay? So these dermal papillae indent into the overlying epidermis. So the epidermis kind of goes down over top of these papillae. Many of these papillae contain capillary loops. Others contain free nerve endings, such as pain receptors, and then touch receptors, such as Meissner's corpuscles. So again, this is the live area. So we have nerve endings here, which can give pain or pressure, or tickle, or so forth. But we also have blood here, blood supply. So we have these capillary loops. Think of, you know, capillaries coming up this papillae, one side being red, oxygenated blood, the other side being blue, deoxygenated blood as the blood is traveling through the papillae, supplying the dermis, and also through diffusion, supplying the needs of the epidermis superior to it or superficial to it. So far, so good? On the palms and the soles of the feet, the papillae lie atop larger mounds called dermal ridges, and these, the papillae and the dermal ridges, produce these looped and whorled ridges on the epidermal surfaces. And we know them as whorls. There's your clue. Whorls on your fingertips are called, the police test for them, fingerprints. Okay? So these ridges that the papillae sit on deliberately create these whorls. If you saw your fingerprints, if you want to call it that, under a microscope, they're actually quite deep whorls. So the ridges increase the gripping ability and therefore increase friction. That's the reason why you're there. Those whorls on your fingers actually do help you with your grip. And of course, as we all know, no two people in the world have the same. Every single one of us has a different pattern on our fingertips. The patterns are genetically predetermined, and we do have sweat pores that open along those ridges. So therefore, anytime we touch something, we leave an oil that is patterned the same as our whorls and our ridges, and then the police come along with a very, very fine dust, and that dust settles in on the oils around those ridges, which gives the distinct patterning that is seen when they're looked at as fingerprints, shall we say. Same as when they place the ink on the finger and then place that inked finger on paper, those whorls show up on there, which we call fingerprints. Okay, you can see that the papillae here as they extend up into the epidermis. Now the reticular layer lies deep to the papillary layer. So remember we had, you know, those five layers of the epidermis, bacilli at the bottom, corneum at the top, and then we have the dermis, the superficial layer of the dermis, is the papillary layer, and then deep to the papillary layer, the deeper layer of the dermis is known as the reticular layer. It accounts for 80% of the dermis, dense irregular connective tissue. What is a good property about dense irregular connective tissue? Why do we want it irregular? Yes. Yes, in what way? Correct, right? So the fact that it's irregular means that no matter what kind of force, shearing force is placed on the skin in any direction, the pattern of these fibers in this connective tissue provides strength in any given direction. Whereas in a muscle tendon, they run longitudinally, down the longitudinal axis, so they only have strength in one direction. If you place force in a different direction, they're quite weak and they can tear. Whereas you can grab your skin and pull it in any direction you want, and it's got strength in all directions. which is integral to, you know, our ability to move and still provide strength and so forth. So this is why it's dense irregular connective tissue. The matrix contains thick bundles of collagen fibers that run in various planes, with the majority running parallel to the surface. Okay, when I say parallel to the surface, I mean you won't see many collagen fibers running this way. They're all running this way, even though they're running here, 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 right? Okay, but they're running parallel to the apical surface. Less dense regions between these bundles form lines of cleavage or tension lines, and they run longitudinal in the skin of the heads and limbs and a circular pattern around the head and trunk. So these lines of cleavage are very interesting, the way the body has set them up. On the limbs, right, when we look at the limbs, we look at the longitudinalness of these lines, and then in the trunk and neck, they run in circular lines. This is why, from a surgical perspective, quite often when we're looking at appendicular procedures, such as the legs and the arms, the incisions run lengthwise. Whereas when we're looking at abdominal surgeries, we tend to see the surgical entrance into the body being running parallel to these lines. The idea being that the less damage they do to the connective tissue, the less likelihood of severe scarring and dysfunction and so forth. Now, there are times where, like open heart surgery, yeah, the line goes this way, but we really can't open the chest this way to get to the heart, so we do have no choice but to go this way and to approach the heart that way, right? But they do run that way. Okay, so you can see here, all this red represents the collagen fibers, and you can see all the different directions that they run. You can see embedded in this reticular dermis, you can see here's a sweat gland, here's a blood vessel, here's some more sweat glands that we can see here, and again, all this sort of pink area is all collagen fibers, and you can see all the different directions it's running to provide strength. The collagen gives strength and resiliency. Now, collagen binds water, which helps hydrate the skin, and I talked about this with the lecture on connective tissue. What holds the water in connective tissue? Proteoglycans. I have this thing about proteoglycans. And I think in my lecture I talked about how they look like a toothbrush, and water molecules stick onto each of those bristles, and hydrated collagen or hydrated connective tissue moves nice and, you know, is resilient and malleable, whereas when that water disappears and it dries up, that's where we get sticky and we have pain patterns that patients have. So collagen binds water, which helps hydrate the skin. Extreme stretching can tear the dermis, which then results in stretch marks. So if the skin gets stretched enough, these collagen bands get pulled apart, and then we get weakness between them, which results in tears that look like stretch marks. So we see a significant separation between the two. And unfortunately, for those folks who spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in these special creams or oils that you can buy at Shoppers Drug Mart, right, we don't put them back together again. They can't go back together again. The damage is done. They get pulled apart. So if a woman is pregnant and has a very large belly, then the collagen fibers and the connective tissue of the dermis in the belly, of course, get stretched because of the size of the tummy, and they'll get torn apart in some cases, and that's where you get your stretch marks from. Okay? Those stretch marks lotions, what they do is you rub them on, and the tear area between the two bundles of collagen superhydrates and fills in that indentation and looks smooth again. You get up the next morning and it's back. Yeah, kind of, but except the body sucks it up and disappears and comes back again. A blister, and this is a separation of the dermal and epidermal regions, so I've got a picture here in a moment, but ultimately when you see that big watery blister come up with, you know, a friction area, and you see the white of the dome of the blister and the red underneath, the white dome is the epidermis and the red underneath is the dermis, okay? Flexure lines reflect dermal modification, so for example, those lines on your palm that people say can tell your future are nothing more than flexure lines where the movement of the hand opening and closing causes alterations in the connective tissue, which results in lines. Yeah, that's right. How come no one reads the lines on your feet then? Maybe. Flexion lines are obvious in the wrists, palms, soles, fingers, and toes. So we even have them here, right? You can see the flexor lines here at the bottom of your, between your wrist and your forearm. You can see those. All they are just flexor lines where the constant movement causes these creases, if you want to call, to occur in the connective tissue underlying dermis. It's just these creases come. They occur at or near joints where the dermis is tightly secured. And that's the other thing about skin. Skin has areas on the body where it's loose and areas on the body where it's quite connected. If it didn't, if your skin and underlying dermis, you know, we're talking, what do we say, 4 kilograms here? Under gravity, if you didn't have anchor points of your skin under gravity after a couple of years, where would all your skin be? In your ankles, right? So we do have points where skin does find connection, which keeps it in place. One example, a very large area of skin is anchored, is in the sacral area. So you'll probably know, have you guys done any connective tissue testing yet, sort of some degree? That's okay. You will. You'll see the skin is very, very tight around the sacrum, and it needs to be. That's one of the anchor points, right? Whereas when you get up into around the shoulder blades or on the scapula, there's a lot more movement to the skin because it's kind of lying more loose there, okay? So we can see here, we can see stretch marks. So this is what you're probably somewhat used to. You can see that, you know, you had these bundles and they've been pulled apart and you get the change in between the two. And this is where the connective tissue has been ripped apart to some degree and you get a modification in between because the two can't come together. These are significantly more damage done, more acute. Now, these can be associated with end-stage cirrhosis, liver failure. You'll tend to see these here. I always tell the story that a lady I used to treat, she was 20-something when I treated her, and she came in and she wanted a massage, you know, like anybody else, and I asked her, you know, any issues, and she said yes, that she had a connective tissue disorder. And I said, okay, is there anything in particular? She said, well, it's just that my skin's loose. Because I've lost a lot of, didn't have the good collagen deposition in her skin, so her skin was more like a Sharpay, if you want to use that term. You know, everybody know what a Sharpay is? No? Japanese or Chinese? I can't remember if Sharpay are, they're a fighting dog. Yeah, but I can't remember if they're Chinese or Japanese. It doesn't matter. They're Asian. We'll just say that. So a Sharpay is deliberately loose skin. They're used for fighting so that if they're attacked by another dog and bitten, it won't do any damage. Just the skin will get in the aggressor's mouth and won't damage. Suffice to say, the lady could get on the table and she would be prone with me on the table. And I literally, and I'm not exaggerating, I could grab the skin of her back and pull it up this far. Because there was no turgor to her skin. Her skin wasn't, there was not enough connective tissue in it. From her neck down, everything was like, it was just loose. Everything was loose because she was unable to produce the collagen fibers required to maintain normal skin turgor and elasticity. So everywhere in her body, I could literally pick up piles of her skin. They just unfortunately just hung. And then on top of that, she had massive stretch marks, striae, all over her body because the skin would be pulled apart and within that connective tissue and couldn't heal. So she was quite affected by it. So you may come across it. There's lots of connective tissue disorders out there. You'd be surprised. You are going to come across it at some point with some patients. It just depends on how it's affected and the difference between the two. Here is a blister. This one's a bit better. So you can see here, this is one on the heel. And the reason I have this on here is because the white represents the epidermis and the red underneath represents the dermis. So you can see here with an acute accumulation of interstitial fluid, you can see that the fluid has pushed the epidermis up, and deep to that fluid is the dermis, which you can see here after it's broken. So this is the dermis underneath. You can see lots of red because there's blood supply and so forth, whereas this part is very, very white because this represents the epidermis and, of course, no blood supply and those sorts of things, so it takes on that white look to it, right? Sometimes I get questions about tattoos because everybody's into tattoos now, it seems. So what happens when they do a tattoo? When you have a tattoo, the needle punctures through the epidermis into the dermis, and once the needle goes into the dermis, it then ejects its ink. So what you see as a tattoo is you are looking at the ink through the epidermis into the dermis. So that ink is actually in the dermis, not in the epidermis. But you're looking through it to get at it. This is why some people have problems where the way their body physiology is, over a couple of years, the edges of the tattoo get less defined because it's moving through that dermis and blood supply and the edges. That's why some people need a touch up every now and then, because you get this sort of moving out of the ink where it was penetrated into the dermis. Okay. This is why, though, you have to be very careful with dry it with appropriate clean needles and so forth, because you are going into blood supply and the potential for AIDS or those kind of diseases are quite high, because you are actually taking the needle and putting it into the blood supply and injecting that area. And it's also the reason why you bleed when you get a tattoo, right, as far as that goes. Right. Now, that's also the problem why they're so hard to get rid of. Anybody here ever attempted to get rid of a tattoo? I dated a lady many years ago, and she had one she really didn't like on her leg. It was quite colored. It was an extremely largely colored tattoo. And what they do is they literally take a laser, and the laser penetrates through the dermis into the epidermis and then blows up. So it takes the ink in the dermis and blows it up so that it makes it into tiny little pieces or little parts where the macrophages can then come along and eat those little tiny pieces of ink and disappear. The thing is, the laser works really well with some colors and not so well with other colors. And I didn't know what it was like until she came home from an appointment having been lasered, and she had a massive bandage on. It was soaked in blood. It's a very bloody technique because they are blowing up the dermis around the ink. So consider well when you have your tattoo and be happy to carry it for all your life. So don't put your boyfriend's name on it, because he might not be your boyfriend 10 years down the road, and then you got to deal with it, right? Take a break. I'll see you guys at top of the hour. Yeah. Top of the hour. Okay. So we talked a little bit about melanocytes. Skin color can be clinically important in terms of recognizing or you having to consider the possibility of a pathological condition. So because the color of skin can denote certain things like inflammation, certain diseases, and so forth. So three pigments are involved in skin color: melanin, which we talked about, keratin, which is, kind of comes from carrots, hence its name, and then, of course, hemoglobin, which gives blood the red color, right? So when hemoglobin is oxygenated, it's red, and that's what gives us a little bit, as I said, that underlying glow, shall we say. And now, melanin is made from tyrosine, which is an amino acid. It ranges in colors from yellow to reddish-brown to black. And, of course, synthesis of this product depends on an enzyme called tyrosinase, which is produced in the melanocyte. So we have to, there's some chemical reactions that occur that, result in the color that can be given. You have to remember that, of course, these melanosomes that are created in the melanocyte pass through these extensions into the basal keratinocytes. And, of course, racial differences is the result of both the kind and amount of pigment. So, depending on where in the world one comes from, we have, the variations of color that we do have. Freckles and pigmented moles are basically where we accumulate melanin, where the melanin kind of aggregates together and forms these particular spots where, because they've come together closely, there's a more enhanced sort of nature to the color of the skin. So keratin then is yellow to orange. So melanin was more within yellow to reddish brown to black. Keratin is the yellow to orange pigments found in certain plant products such as carrots. And what's important about this, it's a great antioxidant because it contains vast amounts of vitamin A. A is a product that prevents free radicals from damaging cells. So So the problem is, though, A is a fat-soluble vitamin, and it's not related to this course, but just remember this, because I know people are into taking vitamins. When you take water-soluble vitamins, if you have too much of them in your body, you basically pee it out. When you take fat-soluble vitamins and you have too many, they accumulate in the liver and can produce toxic levels. So fat-soluble vitamins are A, D, E, and K. You take too many of those, you can actually make yourself sick. Things like go blind, have tremors, all sorts of things can occur. So with your fat solubles, A, D, E, and K, you have to be very careful of the amounts that you take. Whereas all your other ones, vitamin C and you know, all sorts of things, they, as I said, you get too many of them, you just urinate them out, they pass through in the urine. So you have to be a bit careful with them, that's all. And I mean, you've probably seen there have been a fair number of articles lately in the news in regards to overuse of things like vitamin D. Because there is vitamin D deficiency in Canadians, and the recommendation doctors sometimes is to take large amounts of it, and then people go, well, if the doctor says I can take one, maybe I'll take three. Maybe that'll get me better faster, and then you get these accumulations and problems. So you have to be very aware of them. But A is one of them, but keratin arises from that. It tends to accumulate in the stratum corneum and the fatty tissues of the hypodermis. This is why, you know, when you saw that picture of the platysma the other day, the fat on that cadaver looked like yellow chicken fat. And it is. Our fat tends to be of the yellowish nature because you do get accumulation of this keratin in the fat, which gives it that yellow look. And really good, healthy chickens, if you've ever had a really nice free-range organic bird, the fat is very yellow in nature because it's storing this particular fat-soluble vitamin. The yellowness is most obvious in the palms and soles due to the thickening of the corneum here. So the thicker amount will have that, show that sort of that more orangey color simply because of the accumulation of the cells. And we can also, though, turn orange or yellow when we eat too many carrots. So vitamin A was one of those vitamins a number of years ago that got really popular, and there was a couple of stories of individuals who ate bags and bags and bags and bags of carrots, and they turned orange. No kidding. They turned orange. It accumulated so much. Hemoglobin contributes to the pinkish hue of the skin. Basically what it is the red blood cell becomes fulfilled with oxygen molecules, and that turns it red. In fact, if you cut yourself, the reason your blood looks so red when you cut is because the exposure of the blood, because normally you cut venous blood. Right, you're cutting the blood in a vein, hence the reason why it's not squirting all over the place when you cut yourself, it's just kind of running out of the wound. It is a little darker in nature, but as soon as it gets exposed to the open air and the vast amount of oxygen in our environment, it turns that blood red color because the hemoglobin in the red blood cells in that exposed blood picks up all the oxygen and turns very, very red. So it's a result of the red hemoglobin in the red blood cells that circulates through the dermal capillaries. Obviously, it's much more noted in Caucasian people. Now, when we have a low oxygen environment inside our cells, so when the blood isn't well oxygenated, that individual can look blue. They are said to be cyanotic. For those who did the terminology quizzes, cyan is what? Right, Latin for blue. So we see blue lips, the skin can look blue, and this is an individual who's got very low oxygen in the blood. In darker-skinned people, where it's a little more difficult to take note of, where we look is in the inside of the eye or behind the lips where the skin isn't as pigmented and it becomes more obvious. So when we look at skin color and disease states, redness, erythema, indicates the embarrassment, fever, hypertension, inflammation, or allergy. So you know, red-looking skin could mean an infection in that area. Yes. Because they've had vasoconstriction in the area. When a person's really cold, the body deliberately takes peripheral blood vessels and shuts them down to flush all the blood into the more important, deeper areas of the body. It's also the reason why when someone's having a heart attack, they go cardiac gray. Same thing happens. The body deliberately vasoconstricts all the peripheral blood vessels to get blood down into the cardiovascular system and the heart where it's having problems. Pallor or blanching, so turning white can be emotional stress, can be anemia or low blood pressure. It can result in having that sort of whitening. Jaundice means yellow looking, so this can be representative of liver or biliary disorders. What happens is the bile that's produced in the liver accumulates in the blood and turns the individual this yellowish tone. It can be significant. They can actually look neon yellow, especially if they're in end-stage cirrhosis. Okay. Bronzing is very unique to a metabolic disorder called Addison's disease. And it occurs in the gums, and the gums can look like they're made of bronze. You can get a real bronzy color to them. Okay. Black and blue marks, of course, can be bruising. Fundamentally, a bruise is basically tissue damage with escaped blood into the interstitial spaces. So it's escaped blood from circulation with clotting. It can also which can also be these clotting and blue marks can be the result of vitamin C or hemophilia or a person taking anticoagulants, you know, for preventing strokes or any kind of clotting disorders. They'll take drugs that makes their blood, the layman's term is the blood is thin, blood thinners. But the reality is it's an anticoagulant drug which slows the clotting mechanism. Okay, so these people have a potential to bleed more. So here we can see red skin. So the lady on the left has something called contact dermatitis. Ladies, does it look like the way you might put like a moisturizing cream on before you go to bed at night? Does, doesn't it? Okay, so what happens is this individual probably went like this with her cream, and she had an allergic reaction to it, and that inflammation is the contact of the cream and whatever was in it. The body had an inflammatory response and goes red like that. Okay, and then of course here on the right, the same lady that's after treatment on the right, on the left, she has a condition called acne rosacea, and you get this significant redness in the bridge of the nose and over the cheek area. You'll learn these pathologies in path one. Blanched skin. So, of course, albinism, right, can result in very, very significant white-looking skin. I did talk about how in darker-skinned people, where do we need to look to find if there is blanching? So we can see in this picture with a darker individual that, you know, be very difficult to determine blanching in the skin of the face and so forth. But when we look at the mucous membranes behind the eye, that should be red, 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 and it's very white. So we know now that this individual is having an issue. Could be that they have low oxygen levels in their blood. There could be a number of reasons for it, bleeding disorder, somewhere else, those sorts of things. So this is how we can determine that a little bit more in someone with a darker persuasion. That picture has not been fixed. Not been fixed. I've seen lots of patients like this in the hospital. And that is end-stage cirrhosis. Yeah, I can even tell by the fact he's got bruising in the arms, the shape of his body. This is probably end-stage cirrhosis from drinking. And the liver is shut down, and you have this massive accumulation of bile that the blood normally doesn't deal with, and it's gone all over the body, and you do see this color. That's not unusual to see. Yep, many babies are, so you have to go under the UV lamp. Yeah. Yes, yeah, it's because the liver isn't matured enough yet. It's not dealing with the bile yet. So it's just a matter of putting it under the lamp, getting rid of it, getting it settled down, the liver starts kicking in and everything's good. It's a relatively benign thing. It can represent a possibility of a liver problem in a child, which they would, of course, investigate, but most of the time it's not much of anything. There's your bronzing with Addison's disease. So you can see you get this bronzy, kind of shiny look to the gums with it. Pretty distinct. Bruising. Remember I talked about blood thinners? That's what you can expect to see. So that could be nothing more than just an individual who whacked their leg in the side of a chair in long-term care. They're on anticoagulants. The blood hasn't the ability to clot well, and they've bled into the interstitial space. It looks terrible, but probably isn't really that painful for the individual that's going through this. It just looks crazy to us. I would check her blood levels for anticoagulant. They might be too high, and then you would adjust accordingly. But this is not something that's going to end someone's life per se, unless it continued to bleed and get very enlarged. Then you've got a problem. To give you an example, I used to do phlebotomy in the hospital. Phlebotomy is where you take blood from people. had to work with this lady. I did this lady in the morning, and I, of course, there's lots of paperwork when you do it to make sure it's the right person you're sticking the needle in and all that kind of stuff. So did my thing, took my blood, put a gauze on her, told her to squeeze really tightly, turned my back to her, did all the paperwork, put the stickers on the tubes, put them all away. She goes, I think I have a problem. And I turn around, and it's like she took her arm and dumped it in a can of red paint all the way to her elbow, and was dripping off her fingertips. So from that little tiny poke from the needle, because she couldn't clot, her entire arm was covered in blood. You're shaking like you've seen it before. Yeah, it just pours everywhere. Yeah. So, you have no idea how much you're clotting all the time. Like, even if you have a bit of inflammation in your gums, you're clotting there, those sorts of things. So it can be quite simple. It can just be a simple, bang, and then that's what you get. When we look at bruising, what's important is diet, and I do talk about this a little bit later, but looking at the color of the bruise, this is much more acute. This is a little bit older. So what happens is when the blood goes into the interstitial spaces, the body wants to maintain the iron in the blood. So it has mechanisms by which it goes into the bruise and breaks it down, and it removes the iron to put back in the body to use for further creation of blood cells. So that's why bruises change color, because the macrophages come in and break down the components of the blood and so forth. So it goes from, red, purple to kind of different colors to then to yellow and green and whatever. And that's just the breaking down. And the color of a bruise can determine, give you a sense of how old a bruise is. So if you look at a bruise that's really quite dark purple and red, it's probably a pretty acute bruise. You want to be kind of careful around it. If it's a kind of yellowy, greeny color, it's very old and the body's in the process of breaking down the blood that was in the interstitial spaces, and you don't have to worry so much about it. Okay. Any questions? All right, so those accessory things of the skin are appendages of the skin. So the skin we've kind of done now, we've got the epidermis and its layers, the dermis and its layers, but there are associated things to the integumentary system. So the first is hair, okay? So as compared to other mammals, our hair is not as protective or insulative. It's more a little bit of a sensory organ. It does protect the head from the sun and helps heat loss from the scalp. And, of course, eyebrows and eyelashes help prevent things from getting into the eye, like dust particles and so forth. They can get captured by the hair around our eyes to some degree. Ours is more of a sense organ through these hair root plexuses. So we have very small nerves that attach at the base of a hair so that when our hair gets touched, we feel something, even though the individual is not touching the skin at all, just touching the hair, you will get feedback from it on your arm or wherever it may be. In adulthood, each gender, of course, has specific hair patterns, and it's likely that testosterone is what affects what is, traditionally a male pattern of hair versus a female. Obviously, males have generally a lot more hair than females do over the entire body, whereas females generally don't have that sort of full body pattern of hair. And the thoughts are it's around this testosterone and how it influences hair patterning. So what's hair look like? There are only a few areas of the body that don't have hair. Palms of the hands, soles of the feet, lips, nipples, and some areas of the external genitalia. We won't find hair. There's no hair follicles in that area. Months before birth, you start to form these follicles. And in some cases, anybody here ever had a relative, brother, sister, whatever, that were born with all kinds of hair all over their body? Yeah? And it just all falls out, right? So there are babies that are born very covered in hair all over their body, and within days it all falls out. It's just, the follicles have started and they're doing their thing inside mom. And my brother was born, he had a full head of hair. They called him the fifth beetle because he was born in 62, 63, because he had a full head of black hair. Hairs can also be called pili. Basically, it's a flexible strand produced by the hair follicle. So the hair follicle that I said lies in the dermis is kind of the live part of the hair that extends out this strand that we see, growing out of our head or our arms or wherever. It consists largely of keratinized cells But the keratinized cells in hair is different than the keratin that we see in skin. So it's much more firm in the keratinized cells of the epidermis, much softer keratin when we're looking at the hair itself. But ultimately, hair is made of protein, okay? Hair is dominated by hard keratin while skin is dominated by soft. The hard keratin is tougher, more durable, and the cells don't flake. When we look at this superficial part, it is the hair shaft, and it is the hair shaft that projects out that you see on your head. That is the shaft, okay? The hair root is the portion of the hair that's in the dermis. So your hair that you see on your head has actually come up out of the dermis via the hair follicle, and then this is all this is considered the shaft, no matter how long it is or it isn't, all right? So we can see here, this is the shaft of the hair outside, and of course the root is down here coming out of the working part of the hair, which is called the follicle, okay? So the root, we say, is therefore then embedded in the skin, whereas the shaft, of course, was external. It penetrates the dermis and sometimes the subcutaneous layer. You can get down deep enough that it's right at that sort of where the dermis ends and the subcutaneous starts. You can have a bit of it in that area here. Now, there are three layers of cells. So whether it's the shaft or it is the root, both of them have three layers to hair, no matter what it is. You have the medulla, the cortex, and the cuticle. So you can see here, the medulla is at the very center, the cortex is next, and then we have the cuticle around it. Now, when we get down to the follicle, we'll talk about the internal, external root sheaths and so forth. But for now, we're just talking this purple, red, yellow area. Medulla in the center, cortex in the middle, surrounded by the cuticle. Now, the medulla, I said, it can be lacking in thinner hair, and it's generally 2 to 3 rows of irregular shaped cells. So we can kind of see it coming up here, right? So yellow here, the medulla. So we had the matrix here. We're not going to worry about that at the moment. Medulla is running all the way up through, all the way up through. And then, yeah, as I said, in thin hair, it can somewhat be lacking. The cortex is the middle, sort of the bigger part around the medulla, and it is considered to be the major part of the shaft, and we can see it here in the purple. Is there any hairdressers here, by the way? Sometimes I teach hairdressers, and they know all this stuff more than I do. The cuticle, then, is the outermost layer. So it's the one that sort of surrounds, and what you're looking at when you look at your hair right now or the person beside you, fundamentally what you're looking at is their cuticle. That's the outer part. It's the outermost layer. It is a single layer of thin, flat cells that are heavily keratinized. What's interesting about them, they're shaped like shingles on a roof. Okay? So they layer on, and the edges face superiorly. So I take a strand of hair, my arm represents a strand of hair coming up out of the skin. The cells of the cuticle are like this, not like this. Okay? It seems counterintuitive, but the reason it's there is it prevents the hair from matting together and becoming all this entanglement. So the reason why they face that way is they kind of let them bounce off each other and be a little more separated. The cuticle also provides strength and keeps the layers underneath it, so the medulla the cortex, a little more tightly compacted. If the cuticle wears away and breaks down, especially at the tip, you get what's frizz called? Split ends. How did you know that? Which is that. Under electron microscope, that's a split end. So the cuticle is completely broken down, and the cells of the underlying structures just start spreading out because they're not held intact. It looks far worse under an electron microscope than it does when you look at it yourself in your hair. But that's ultimately what's happening. You can see here, and this is a lovely picture. This is actually like electron microscope. This is the epidermis. These are the dead cells on the apical surface. That's what your skin actually looks like when you get down deep and look at it very microscopically. And you can see here the shaft coming out, and you can see the cuticle cells facing upwards away, which prevents the hairs from all matting together. So you can see how if you have overproduction of these apical cells sloughing off, you can see how you get dandruff, because it's just that layer just accumulating within the hair and so forth, and you get dandruff. Crazy, eh? When you look at it, you think hair is smooth. Under the microscope, it's not as smooth as you think it is. The color, of course, again, created by melanocytes at the base of the hair follicle and transferred to the cortical cells. So the same thing that colors your skin, colors your hair. And when we look at, you know, the various colors that can occur, of course, genetically influenced. And, of course, the parts of the world that we come from, originally, we get the variation of the colors that we do get. Nowadays, with ladies, you never know whose real color is, because 99% of you all color your hair some way or another, so who knows what your color, natural color is. Portions of various melanins, of course, different colors, yellow, rust, brown, black, to combine and produce the various colors of hair. Gray or white is because there is no pigment, and the light that travels through the hair shaft gives you the perception of white because there's no color in the hair. Okay, that's why it looks that way. It's the air bubbles in there that kind of cause that to look that way. Now, the shaft, of course, I said, is the superficial portion which projects above the surface of the skin, but ultimately it is a continuation of the root's three concentric layers, medulla in the middle, surrounded by the cortex, and all of those surrounded by the cuticle. So same thing as we saw down in the root, no different. Now, the follicle, that is the working end. So everything we've talked about in terms of the shaft and the part that comes out, you know, it's dead, it's getting elongated, but how's it getting elongated? It's getting elongated by the cell production that's occurring in this part of the hair, which is the follicle. So it extends from the epidermal surface into the dermis, and it surrounds the root of the hair. At its deep end, it expands to form what's called the bulb, which is down at this area here. A knot of sensory nerve endings called a hair root plexus surround the follicle. So this is why I can touch your hair and not touch your skin, and you'll know your hair is being touched, because the movement of the shaft and the external part of the hair, just its movement, gets stimulates the hair root bulb, the hair root plexus, and you feel like someone's touching your hair. So the plexus wraps around each hair bulb, and as I said, bending the hair stimulates the plexus, and we can feel that someone's touching our hair. It is the plexus and the ability to sense movement that makes hair its sensory organ. Now, within this follicle, there is something other than just the three layers of the medulla, the cuticle, and the cortex. This working part sits within something. We say that there are two layers to it. There is an internal root sheath that we can see here in orange, and an external root sheath. The internal root sheath is formed by the dermis, and the external root sheath is formed by the invagination of the epidermis. So what we're saying is that the epidermis at this area penetrates down into deep in the dermis, and that's what the follicle sits in. So we have the epidermis externally, and then we have the dermis internally, and then we have the follicle itself that it sits within. Together, the layers are called the epithelial root sheath. So we can see right here. So we've got the internal root sheath, which is created by the dermis, and the external root sheath, which is created by the epidermis. They both invaginate down deep, and it is within that tube that's created that we find the follicle, and it is the hair shaft and root that rises out of the follicle, and hence the reason why your hair grows longer all the time, because that's where all this is occurring. There's a dense dermis that surrounds the hair follicle, and it is though the dermal nerve sheath, as I said, which is this area here. As the most inferior surface, there is a nipple-shaped indentation called the papilla that we see here in yellow. And the papilla contains a knot of capillaries, because this is where cell division takes place, hence the reason why your hair grows long. So we, not unlike what we looked at with the epithelial layer, right? We had, you know, down here in the basal area, we had cells that were dividing and were very active. The same thing is happening here. At the matrix, this is the active portion of hair growth. So we can see that we have the matrix here, which of course would be cellular division, which would rise apically, just like it does in the skin, but now it's hair, so it's rising apically. And to maintain the metabolic needs of the cells in the matrix, we need this papilla, which allows for a capillary to come up into it, which of course via blood supplies the cells in order to divide and thus creating the elongating hair. Everybody follow me so far? Okay. You can also note there's melanocytes, which give pigment the cells, which gives the hair color as it's leaving and heading out externally. Now, the matrix is composed of stem cells, and researchers are actually looking into these stem cells to see if they can differentiate them into other structural things. I don't think it's going so well, but they're attempting to. But ultimately, it's the matrix cells that are responsible for the growth of the existing hair. So it's cellular division that's happening in this matrix and pushing upwards that has our hair grow longer and longer and longer over time, because these cells are continually dividing and pushing upward. So matrix cells are responsible for the growth of existing hairs and for the growth of new ones. In normal hair, we should have a balance between hair loss and hair growth. So as we all know, you know, you brush your hair or in the shower washing your hair, you have hair in your hand, right? But under normal circumstances, yes, you are losing hair, but it's behind it is constantly being replaced by other follicles that are replacing those hairs that you lost some time ago, and there's a balance to constantly maintaining, so you have the perception that that you know you're fine with your hair. Anything that damages the follicle, such as I said earlier, cholesterol in the blood supply here, and you get cholesterol that blocks these, and there's no blood supply to the matrix, then there's no longer any hair production, and then that hair falls out and never gets replaced. So we get certain patterning where follicles get destroyed in certain patterning, hence why we call it, you know, male pattern balding, where, you know, the cells are, these papillae in the matrix are dying off because the blood supply has been cut off and the hair is dying off and not being replaced. So we start losing in particular patterns. Can ladies go bald? Yes, they can. Lots of dependence around that, but it can definitely happen. Now within here, we have something called the erector pili, and it's a muscle. It is associated with the follicle, and it does approach the skin surface at an oblique angle from the follicle, and you can kind of see it there in the diagram. It is the attachment of this muscle in this sort of this oblique angle that when it contracts, it creates goosebumps. Okay, so this muscle, this is why when you have goosebumps, if you looked at your hair when you're all goosebumpy, the hair has been pulled up to try to straighten. It's a leftover from our animal part because there are certain animals where their hair gets straight and sticks out when they're fearful or they're feeling like they need to fight. Yes? What do we call it in dogs? What's up when they're upset? Their hackles, right? We say the dog's hackles are up. The hair by their bum sticks right up straight, right? And it's a evolutionary reaction to look larger so that that what they're feeling threatened by will be afraid because they suddenly look bigger. It's why they tell us if you got a bear and you think the bear's coming, get big. Get really, really big. Just give them more to bite, right? But get really, really big. It may scare them away. I've been chased by a bear, a big black bear. I didn't know you could run without your feet touching the ground. Okay. The next thing, accessory, we have our glands. Now, when we talk about glands as it relates to this type of area, glands are a form of epithelial tissue. The main thing about glands is they secrete, right? Many things. So we can see we've got a sebaceous gland. We have a sweat gland, an apocrine sweat gland. We have an eccrine sweat gland. There's a number of different glands that are related to epithelial tissue and, of course, to the integumentary system as well. So the first is the sebaceous glands. Sebaceous glands are known as oil glands. They're connected to the hair follicle directly. They lie in the dermis and they open into the follicle. So the oils that you get quite often are secreted into the follicle, and the oil travels along the hair shaft and then goes out into the skin. Okay? So we find these in lips gland, the glans penis, the labia minora, and glands of the eyelids. The areas have the glands secrete directly on the surface of the skin. Everywhere else in the body, the gland secretes into the follicle, and then the oil goes out along the hair. But these other areas, the lips, glands, penis, and so forth, labia minora, and the eyelids, the oil goes directly out of the gland directly onto the skin itself. There's no hair that's used to move the oil about. So we can see here, here's your sebaceous gland here. It's going to secrete into the hair follicle area here. And then, of course, it follows the hair out. And then the oil goes out onto the skin. Sebaceous gland produces something called sebum, which is a mixture of triglycerides, cholesterol, proteins, and salts. Okay, so there's some significant compounds to what the secretion is. It also helps coat the hair and keeps them from drying out. Everybody here has heard, right, you really shouldn't wash your hair every day. Right? You should let it get a bit oily. It's actually good for your hair to have your body produce the natural oils for your hair. And the sebum prevents excessive evaporation of water from the skin, and it does inhibit some growth of bacteria, but not all bacteria. Hence the reason why, you know, if you go too many days without washing your hair, what's your hair smell like? It'll eventually get a bit of an odor to it, correct? Sudoriferous glands are also known as sweat glands. You have over 3 to 4 million of them in your body at any given time. They release sweat directly onto the hair follicles and also directly onto skin. And there are two main types of sweat glands. There are eccrine sweat glands and apocrine sweat glands. Let's do eccrine first. It's the most common of the two. They're found everywhere but the margins of the lips, nail beds of the fingers and toes, the glans penis, glands clitoris, labia minora, or eardrums. Otherwise, they're everywhere else. They produce 600 milliliters of sweat a day. Think of that. How many milliliters in a cup? Is it 500? 500, isn't it? Yeah, 500. Okay, so think of a cup. Almost. It's mostly water with sodium chloride, urea, and sometimes, you ever notice some people have sweat that smells just like urine? You ever notice that? No? Yeah, some people can, because urea does get produced in sweat, and some people, they get a larger percentage of it, so they're in some areas of the body, their sweat may smell a bit like urine. Uric acid, ammonia, amino acids, glucose, and lactic acid. Of course, it is really good for thermoregulation because sweat evaporates, and when it evaporates, of course, it takes heat off the body and helps cool it if it's feeling hot. Like in this room right now, probably everybody is sweating at this point. It does play a small role in eliminating wastes. And this is where, you know, I have discussions sometimes with people who think that going into the sauna and sweating profusely helps release many, many toxins out of the body. Not too much. It does a little bit, but not that much. So you can see here is your eccrine sweat gland right here, sort of working and secreting out on top. The apocrine sweat glands are they're not quite as common. They have much larger ducts as compared to eccrine. So eccrine, the tube, shall we say, the sweat comes out of is fairly small in diameter, whereas these apocrine have a much larger duct that sweat comes out of. Find these basically in the skin of the axilla, the groin, the areoli, and bearded regions of the face in males. The secretion tends to be somewhat milky or yellowish when looked at closely. Right? It's not clear where eccrine is more of a clear sweat. Here it tends to have more of a milky or yellow nature to it. It has the same components as eccrine with lipids and proteins. And guess what? It's odorless. So why do you have BO? What is BO? Yeah, it's the same thing as it was with the dust mite. Bacteria eats your sweat, and then, of course, secretes after eating, and it is the secretion of the bacteria after eating your sweat that you smell. It's not exactly the sweat itself, it's the byproducts of the bacteria eating your sweat that you're smelling. Don't ever think that BO is always meaning someone's dirty. There are many people who struggle with body odor, who do wash every day and use many, many things, and unfortunately still suffer with having a particular scent to their secretions. And so don't always make the assumption that an individual is dirty because they have that smell. Maybe. Maybe. I'm surprised nobody asked me about water. And you know, drink water makes your skin softer. BS. It's all about proteoglycans and how much water it's holding. That's what makes your skin soft. Same as all those lotions you spend hundreds of dollars on for your skin. It's a short term, and then after that. I know many men who don't ever use lotion, and their hands are still pretty soft. apocrine glands, eccrine glands start very early in life, whereas apocrine glands don't start to be part of you until puberty. So there is somewhat of a mature sexual nature to apocrine glands as well. Again, we're animals, scents are important to attraction and so forth. So they start to play a role when we become more sexually mature to, you know, looking for a mate and so forth. You start to play a role in that part of us as well. You can see, so here's your eccrine gland here. And again, your apocrine gland, much larger diameter lumen here, secreting much more. Ceruminous glands, these are modified sweat glands that are in the ear. And these are the glands that produce what you call earwax. Right? So they produce the product in the ear. Now, earwax is important. Why? Yeah, it's sticky. Stuff sticks to it rather than going deep into the ear. So it produces a waxy lubricating secretion, and this secretion is a yellowish material called cerumen, and it is a sticky substance to prevent the entrance of foreign bodies and insects into the ear. Okay, so we can see them here, and of course, the one thing we all never use is, yeah, what are you supposed to use? Little finger. Because it can't get into the eardrum. You can use a washcloth. Just use your fingers. This is easy. No. Yes. Yeah, that's fine. And some people do produce, unfortunately, have cells that are very active and produce large amounts of earwax, and it gets accumulated and they actually affect their hearing. So what they'll do is they'll go in and see a physician. They have a little special tray that goes around the head so it doesn't leak all over the place, and they have a very large syringe, and they go in and they kind of tilt the head and they squirt that material in. It softens the material, and it then falls out and clears the ear out. Unfortunately, some people do produce too much of it, and they tend to get clogged your canals. Yeah, can happen. No, I don't believe so. I think it's just you just naturally have this overactive glands that produce it in some cases for some people. No. Now, some people, I guess, if you were to say they were very lazy and they never cleaned their ears for 15 years, I guess there's a possibility you might accumulate some. But you know what? Under most circumstances, most of us do not have to clean our ears. Just having a shower and the water that goes in and washing it out is usually plenty enough. Yes. I don't think so. I think it's just how your body sort of reacts and produces it. I don't think there's a reactionary production to something in there. I don't believe so. It's in there to help prevent it, but I don't think there's anything that gets stimulated to produce more if something's going on in there. I don't believe so. Now, for those who have tubes in their ears and those sorts of things, it's not this stuff that's the problem. If you look here, you actually have, it doesn't really show it here a little bit, you do have a tube that from the ear actually drains into the back of your throat. you don't taste it because it's way back there. But individuals who have that tube that drains into the throat, if it's very, very narrow, it doesn't drain the ear properly, and they get chronic ear infections because you have static fluid in the ear that gets infected. So what they'll do is they'll use a procedure where they'll actually put a tube into the tube to kind of dilate it to some degree, which allows the tube to drain a bit better. Yeah, I know, it's like a... Is it really? Yeah.
Yeah, I had both.
As an adult or as a child? Oh, interesting. Okay. You know, it's adults, they don't do anything. They just go in and put it in without any putting you to sleep or anything. Yeah. Yeah. But so are the chronic ear infections. Last thing, we'll get finished here, then we'll be done with integument. Nails. They're, again, plates of tightly packed, hard, dead, keratinized epidermal cells. So this skin, the integument system uses epidermal keratinized cells for everything, just about. They form a clear solid covering over the dorsal surface of the distal portions of the digits. There are three parts to it, the nail body, the free edge, and the nail root. And of course, the nail body is what you're looking at, and the white part, of course, is that you clip to trim, of course, is the edge. The free edge is what we clip, and it's white. The nail root is found under the skin. You don't see it, so you can see it down here. And again, just like hair, just like skin, you have a nail matrix with dividing cells that get keratinized and form the nail. It's all the same process. The crescent-shaped area of the proximal end of the nail bed is called the lunula because it thought it looks like the moon, like a half moon. It's white because it's thick in that area. Average growth of nails is 1 millimeters per week, usually slower in toenails. But I have this anecdotal thing that when I started massaging and, you know, using lotion that went into the nails and that, my nails used to grow, I thought, so quickly. Now, it could be just my mind because I had to clip my nails more often and noticed it more. But I always thought that when I was massaging regularly, my nails grew faster. Could be completely out of my mind, but... they protect and provide support to the finger, and of course they help in certain types of grasp and allow us to scratch and groom. So we can see here, we've got the nail bed here. Here's the lunula here that we can see. Now, important, this position of this and its shape can denote certain pathological conditions, and you'll talk a little bit about that when you do skin path later on. But this will show you nails can also relate to pathological condition. These are called club fingers, very common in emphysema or COPD, in patients with COPD. This is a metabolic disorder, something, I can't remember what it is, but the nails can actually peel back and invert on you. And you get ridges and all sorts of things. This is something that's important. And you see the ads on TV. This is toenail fungus. You've seen the ads on TV, you know, where the guy says, I don't have a fungus and whatever. This is, the reason I put this up here, and as bad as they look, when you go into long-term care, which you'll be doing in semester 4, you will see this. Very common. It gets passed along in the bathing areas and that with the people who live in long-term care. It's a fungus, and it is highly contagious. So make sure you're wearing gloves if you're working on their feet. And some here are saying, I'm never working on those feet. But that's nail fungus. And it is very, very difficult to get rid of. Very difficult to get rid of. Okay, we're done. Next week, then, I guess, is cardiovascular. Would that be right? Okay, perfect. I believe this catches us up now, does it not? Just a week?